Staying with China, and Chinese President Xi Jinping is escalating his anti-corruption drive and demands for a return to party values. Richard McGregor is a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute and an experienced China watcher. He's written a new paper called Xi Jinping, The Backlash. It examines reactions to the Chinese leader's hardline style at home and abroad. I spoke to him a short time ago.
Well, he's been in power now for 5-6 years. We should know a lot about him. If you think about US presidents, other powerful people in the world, we know a ton about them. In the case of Donald Trump, we know too much probably. But with Xi Jinping, we're still sort of putting the puzzle together. We know when he was sort of first selected, not elected for the job, that, you know, he's red nobility. His father was a famous revolutionary. He's also come up through the system. He served in lots of different parts of China, so he's well qualified like that. But when he was first chosen in 2007 to take over in 2012, nobody tipped that he would be as tough, as authoritarian a leader as he is. So the question about him, you know, why did he come to office with such alacrity? And I think there's two elements to that. Number one, in the years before he came to office, other high-level leaders tried to take the job off him. They've since been arrested, Bo Xilai being the most prominent amongst them. But secondly, I think that he's a dedicated member of the Communist Party and an absolute true believer that the Communist Party, only the Communist Party, has the right to rule China. He saw the party crumbling from corruption, from fiefdoms developing, from a slackness in the system. So he's tried to sort of rattle the whole thing and tighten it up. And that's why we see China being led in the way that it is today.
Well, I want to ask you about his anti-corruption push. How do you see that? Some are seeing the benefits in cracking down on corruption, but at the same time, he's making a lot of enemies because he's going after a large number of people and their patronage networks then extend a lot further. So people are being dispossessed, losing their status. So is it good for him or bad, and good for China or not?
Well, I think there's a number of ways of looking at it. First of all, there's fertile ground for an anti-corruption campaign because there was systematic corruption in the Communist Party, and that's one thing that makes ordinary people very angry. So it threatened the party's legitimacy. I don't think it's true, as some say, that he's just used anti-corruption to take out his enemies. Certainly that's happened a little bit, but it's much bigger than that. But the impact of the anti-corruption campaign is much like in any political system where you have a big clean-out or somebody cleans out tons of people. He has created enormous numbers of enemies, bad enemies perhaps. This is one of the themes of my book. And it also goes to explain why he's decided that he's made himself leader in perpetuity. Because I think he's made so many powerful enemies, destroyed so many powerful, rich, privileged families, you know, overnight, as you can do with the executive power of a Communist Party leader, that if he were ever to step down himself, he, or at least his family members or associates and acolytes, would be in danger of being arrested himself. So the anti-corruption campaign has a far-reaching impact beyond just the anti-corruption element, but into the entire body politic.
What about his push of having more influence of the party in private enterprise? A lot of Australians find that difficult to understand. How does this actually happen? Are we talking about seats at the table at board meetings, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's still a little bit opaque. Foreigners even struggle to understand that the party has a fundamental role in big state-owned companies. PetroChina and the like are known down here, but in private company as well. Alibaba, for example, Huawei, a private company, Tencent, the biggest sort of internet company, that all the leaders of those companies are members of the party, and all of those companies have party committees. Now, what do they actually do? If you talk to the Chinese, they'll try and play it down and say, oh, it's simply HR. If there's a personnel dispute, the party committee can handle that and manage it. But increasingly, the party wants to make sure it's involved in executive decisions as well. So, and effectively, they might act like a shadow board. But of course, they don't say what they do, so we don't really know. And so I think for, you know, Chinese companies, Chinese listed companies in Hong Kong and the like, it's certainly something that investors are increasingly focused on.
All of this is unfolding against the backdrop of a trade war with the US and China. Where does that leave Australia, all of these factors playing out at the moment?
in some respects, uncomfortably in the middle. We're already offside with China. You know, so are many other countries. Australia's not alone. If you look around the world, all manner of countries are battling with China and renegotiating their relationship with China in many ways. As far as economically, you know, in the short term, the trade war doesn't hurt us too much. Now, if the US and China were to do these short-term trade deals where China agrees to buy a bunch of agriculture, farm goods and LNG and the like from the US to reduce the bilateral trade imbalance, that could hurt us. But at the moment, our economy is still complementary to China's. We still sell them stuff that they don't have as much as they dislike relying on us. So we're not in any immediate danger, because for China to try to punish Australia economically for political ends, let alone the impact of fallout of a trade war, that hurts China as well. More broadly speaking, US-China trade war is affecting trade globally. It's reducing trade globally. It's cutting economic growth rates globally. So in the short term, that is bad for us as well.
Richard McGregor, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Richard McGregor, Senior Fellow at the Lowy Institute. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. Farmers and scientists are finding new ways to keep food on the table as rainfall patterns change and heat waves increase. Climate change is affecting what's grown and consumed as those on the front line produce food differently. National rural and regional reporter Jess Davis has this story.
On the edge of the Gawler River in South Australia, farmer Anne-Marie Brookman has been ripping up pistachio, walnut and apple trees.
I guess that's the tough decisions that you have to make. The sad thing is pulling them out, but the good thing is seeing how other things cope.
She planted the pistachios 30 years ago because they grow with relatively little water and tolerate high temperatures. But they rely on winter chill to regenerate, and it's no longer cold enough. Her apples and pears can no longer cope with increasing heat waves.
Nothing had a chance to recover overnight and start, you know, the next day afresh. We just found that it completely cooked the apples and the nashis.
But like many farmers across the country, Anne-Marie Brookman is adapting what and how she grows.
You know, we've already had good crops of pomegranates, and we've had good crops of jujubes, so I guess all is not lost.
Professor Richard Eckard from the University of Melbourne says agriculture relies on a predictable local climate.
So every crop exists where it does because we know the distribution of rainfall and we know the distribution of temperature. Climate change threatens those. It threatens the rainfall and it threatens the temperature regimes that a crop or a system is adapted to.
The declining rainfall is challenging many farmers. But for others, like West Australian farmer Mark Adams, their once too wet land is now perfect for growing crops.
We've been adapting for the last 30 years, and I don't think we're going to stop adapting to what the climate throws at us.
Lower rainfall means his crops no longer get waterlogged. And with better farming techniques, Mr. Adams has increased his productivity by 25%.
I don't have a fear in regards to climate change. We've managed with the changes to date and we've increased our production.
At Weeman in northwest Victoria, Angelo Lamatina's family has been growing carrots for nearly 30 years.
The reason why we chose the area we're in is because it had plenty of water. The soil was perfect for growing carrots and the climate conditions were also perfect.
But hotter, drier conditions have made it harder for him to grow carrots.
The point is it's actually the climate is changing and so we need to adapt.
Angelo Lamatina has bought two more properties in cooler climates where he grows during the summer months instead of growing all year round at his family farm.
By doing what we've done, droughts can come and go and not affect our business as much as they would have 20 years ago.
But as climate change accelerates, Professor Richard Eckard says there needs to be more investment from both state and federal governments so food producers can keep up.
A lot of research is still needed to understand what are the adaptation options and to progress some of the adaptation options, because if they are about breeding shorter season varieties, well, we actually need quite a long lead time to get there. It doesn't happen tomorrow.
In a statement to the ABC, the Federal Agriculture Minister says the Australian government has a suite of measures to support climate change adaptation.
That was Jess Davis with that story.